Welcome to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Thank you for tuning in. Well, today's program will include a piece from Psychology Today entitled The Liberating Power of Disability Pride. We'll have an article from the Center for Economic Policy Research about the effects of the recently enacted GOP budget reconciliation bill entitled One Big Ugly Death Sentence for Disabled People. There'll be a piece suggesting some reading selections for Disability Pride Month, along with some other selections, including this article from Dance Magazine entitled Cultivating Authentic Disability Representation in Dance. It was written by Lauren Wingenroth, and it was published July 7, 2025. At times, the opening ceremonies for last year's Paralympic Games was a beautiful celebration of the talents of the disabled dancers and athletes on stage, like when the brilliant South African dancer Musa Motha made magic with his crutches. But then came a moment that many in this disability dance community found upsetting. The non-disabled performers who comprised the majority of the dance ensemble performed a sequence where they seemed to try to emulate Motha's movements, picking up their own crutches and using them as props. That was quite shocking to see for those of us in this field, says Elizabeth Motley, a disabled dancer and choreographer based in New York City. It was a particularly pointed example of the surprisingly common occurrence of disability being simulated, appropriated, or mimicked in dance performance. There's the recent music video for Lady Gaga's Abracadabra, for instance, in which the pop star and her backup dancers use canes to simulate impaired movement as part of their choreography. There's Marie Chouinard's 2005 work, Body Remix Goldberg Variations, where dancers use crutches and prosthesis as tools to explore the limitations and potential of their movement. And characters with disabilities are still frequently played by performers without those identities on Broadway and beyond. This type of simulation can perpetuate harmful ideas about disability and deny opportunities to disabled artists. There's a huge problem with people trying to mimic movement of disabled people without having the lived experience of being in the world as someone who shows up in that way, says Raquel Mesger-Zaffi, co-artistic director of UK-based Kandoko Dance Company, which centers artists with disabilities. It's not authentic, and I don't understand why we're still doing it. Why it happens. To Zaffi's question of why this is still happening, Laurel Lawson, a dancer, choreographer, and founding member of disability arts ensemble Kinetic Light, says she frequently hears the same incorrect answer. The answer people always give us is that there just aren't enough qualified performers, she says. There are plenty of disabled performers. We all know this, and yet there's still the encouragement of non-disabled performers to take up that space. As Alice Shepard, founder and artistic director of Kinetic Light, puts it, if disability is desired, you should hire disabled dancers. New York City-based performer and choreographer Jerron Herman, who explores disability aesthetics in his work, points to a more likely explanation. The fear around saying disability or engaging with disability is how these things come about, he says. It's thought of as cheaper and easier not to engage. Marissa Hamamoto, founder of Infinite Flow Dance, which employs disabled and non-disabled dancers, puts it more bluntly. I think a lot of people are just uncomfortable around people with disabilities, she says. In cases like the Paralympics, it may be that non-disabled dancers have mimicked disability as part of a well-intentioned but misguided attempt to create allegiance between non-disabled dancers and disabled dancers, says Victoria Marks, a choreographer and scholar who directs the Dancing Disability Lab at UCLA. But the social and political identities aren't equal, so it's a false equality. Marks fears that choreographers are drawn to appropriating disability to extend the innovative possibilities of dance, she says. Like, look what I can do with my body. Now look what I can do with a chair on wheels. It's an expansion of the ableist enterprise of dance, to innovate, to rise to the top, to do more cool things, to expand virtuosity for its own sake. The problems with appropriating disability. The harm of appropriating disability goes beyond questions of casting. There are deep implications for mimicry, Herman says. You're saying, we don't need your body for this embodiment and this expression, so it makes the body disposable. The idea that disability can be represented by using a mobility device like a wheelchair or a crutch also points to a problematic misconception about what such devices really are. What people think of as medical equipment is part of our bodies, our embodiments, our personhoods, says Shepherd. When a non-disabled person dances in a wheelchair, the chair is detached from its social and political context, says Marx. They're not neutral objects. They're not interesting things on wheels. Disabled dancers bring training and technique to their movement that can't be quickly learned or replicated. Lawson says it's obvious when a dancer isn't trained in, say, dancing with a wheelchair, and compares it to how easy it is to spot an untrained model wearing point shoes for an advertisement. It's not their body, they don't know what they're doing, and they don't have the technique for it, she says. Like all dance technique, it's something that is learned through years and years of repetition. Confining the performance of disability to a series of rehearsed movements rather than an embodiment of a lived experience is always going to be inaccurate, says Herman. The performance of disability can't be exact, he says. Moving toward authentic representation. There's evidence of growing awareness in dance and theater spaces that disabled characters should be played by disabled performers, and disability shouldn't be mimicked. Perhaps most notably, Jenna Bainbridge became the first disabled performer to play Wicked's Nessa Rose, who uses a wheelchair, earlier this year, more than 20 years after the show opened on Broadway. This followed disabled performer Marissa Bodhi playing the role in the 2024 film adaptation. This kind of authentic representation has real impact. When I was 18 and didn't understand my disability or what it meant to be a disabled performer, that representation was not available to me, says Kandoko Dance Company co-artistic director Dominic Mitchell. I think people underestimate the power it has. It changes the cultural perspective, and it creates opportunities for younger folks to be able to witness themselves. I think it would have transformed my life as an 18-year-old to witness Kandoko. There's still considerable work to be done, both on and off stage. It takes money. It takes time. It means supporting disabled artists and helping us build the training pipeline that is extremely incomplete. It means commissioning disabled choreographers and making work accessible to disabled audiences, says Lawson. It means valuing the lived experience of disability offstage so you can value it in the cultural field, adds Shepherd. The learning in our bodies, some of it from dance studios and some of it from the street, cannot be replicated. What we know about moving is sacred. Beyond representation. Disability justice in dance doesn't start and end with the identities being represented on stage. It's also about power, resources, and access offstage, and who is creating the work we're seeing. If we think about a non-disabled person orchestrating the power dynamics that are on stage, that sets up a place of distrust for me as a disabled person, says Elizabeth Motley, a New York City-based choreographer and performer. Alice Shepard, founder and artistic director of disability arts ensemble Kinetic Light, agrees. It's not just about putting someone on stage, she says. What are you doing with them? Do they have interesting choreography to perform? We can't ignore these questions solely to deal with the question of representation. Just putting disabled people on stage isn't going to solve the problem. You need people who are skilled in understanding the choreographic potential that a disabled dancer brings. Kandoko Dance Company, a UK-based troupe that has historically included both disabled and non-disabled dancers, is reckoning with these questions right now. We're experiencing a transformation in our company because we had the lived experiences in terms of the performers being disabled, but the narratives and aesthetics and the stories have come mostly through non-disabled choreographers, says co-artistic director Dominic Mitchell. We recently made a pivot to commission a disabled choreographer, and the content, the approach, the politics, and the ethics around ways of working has completely changed in really exciting ways. Seeing the work of more disabled makers on stage will require dismantling the barriers that currently exist for them. The labor that is required of disabled dancers to get their work produced is so much more intense than it is for non-disabled dancers, says Motley. The folks who are doing this really brilliant work are reaching fatigue so much earlier. Next is a piece from Connecticut College's magazine, Connections. It's entitled A Beautiful Twist, written by John Sharon. As Conn celebrates the opening of its Disability Cultural Center, educator and activist John Sharon, class of 86, reflects on his own reckoning with disability identity. I was not the first physically disabled student at Connecticut College. That distinction apparently goes to a student who was on campus in the late 1960s, right before or around the time the school went co-ed. I was told that she had cerebral palsy and used a walker to get around. I don't know her name or if she graduated. But before I tell my story, I think it's important to acknowledge that she is someone whose shoulders we all stand on, even today. It was August of 1982 when I arrived with a car full of too much stuff on the steps of Wyndham Dorm. My head was full of too much stuff, too. I was excited to be away from home for the first time and anxious to get this college chapter started. At the time, I didn't think much about disability or accessibility or who I was other than just an eager 18-year-old who wanted to fit in. In fact, I didn't think about my identity much at all back then, to say nothing of my identity as a disabled college student. That would come in the next few years, as much to my own surprise as anybody else's. Let me explain. In 1964, I was born with a rare condition called arthrogryposis multiplex congenita, which causes stiff and fixed joints. And I was also born into a family who did everything they could to make me feel normal, although I dislike that word, just like everyone else. From my earliest memories, I knew I was 100% the same as everybody else because that's the way my family treated me. But I also knew from my earliest memories that I was 100% different from everyone, too. I remember being 4 years old and my mom carrying me across the parking lot after a doctor's appointment and yelling at someone. She got in the car, slammed the door, and said something about staring. So I lived in this duality all my life, the worlds of same and different. And when I got to Conn that fall, I wanted badly, so badly, to be in the world of same that I did not think about the world of different and what that meant. But something odd happened right away. I noticed that people started recognizing me, saying hello to me by name. Yes, of course, deep down, I knew it was because I walked like a drunk penguin, but I didn't acknowledge it, not then. So that fall, on a whim, and because all these people seemed to know who I was, I decided to run for freshman class president. Mind you, I didn't take it very seriously, and I did it as a bit of a joke. But the joke was on me, because I ended up winning that election, and suddenly I had to start acting, well, presidential. And suddenly, I had to start thinking of policies and procedures and what we could do to make students' lives better. But I still wasn't thinking of myself as disabled, wasn't thinking about accessibility. That would come later, when one day after government class, on the fourth floor of Fanning Hall, I was walking down the stairs when a few friends stopped me and said, "Hey, what do you think about accessibility at Conn?" Accessibility at Conn, was that even a thing? These friends had been taking an education class that term, and the topic of Conn's accessibility, or lack thereof, had come up in the day's discussion. These sweet friends were truly baffled by my reply. I had never really thought about it before. But over the next several months, I started to get curious. And the more I looked, the more I saw. And the more I saw, the more I realized that the campus was almost completely and thoroughly inaccessible for anyone who might use a wheelchair for transport, who might be deaf, who might be blind, and I started to get mad. But I knew that anger wasn't going to be the right approach, because that would just shut conversations down when just the opposite was what was needed. So I turned to activism. And I started asking lots of questions. Why wasn't there an elevator going down to the squash courts in the new gym they were building? Why were there so few accessible parking spaces on campus? Why were there so many steps and no ramps? Now, this was before the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, so nothing, not new construction, not renovation, was required to be accessible back then. And because of that, I also knew something else. If I wanted to change the campus in even the tiniest of ways, I couldn't do it by myself. So about a year later, a group of friends and I held the first Disability Awareness Week in Conn's history. We put up posters, we showed movies, we held discussions, and we had about 10 students who volunteered to spend the entire week navigating the campus entirely by wheelchair. We got wheelchairs loaned for free from local pharmacies, and the rules for the students were strict, but rather simple. During the school day, they could not get out of their wheelchairs to walk upstairs, even to a class on the fourth floor of Fanning. They had to be carried up those stairs by their friends. And yes, we deliberately chose students whose classes were in the far corners of inaccessibility on campus, because we knew the value and the power of seeing students needing to be carried up and down flights of stairs. It would hold up a mirror for the college that couldn't be ignored. Finally, on the last day of the week, we had planned to have a big old party. We'd have music and speeches and an amateur wheelchair race down the middle of Crow Boulevard. It was going to be like a disability feralia, only better, because this event had a broader purpose. And, this is crucial, we had notified local media about the day, and they had promised to send reporters out to cover it. On the morning of the final day, I got a phone call from someone who worked in the communications office in Fanning, someone who was fully on board with what we were up to. She said one of the local radio stations had called her because someone from the college had called them that morning and told them not to come, that the planned event had been canceled. I told her to call them back and say the event had not been canceled and was proceeding as planned. So we held the day, the music played, the students spoke, the wheelchairs raced, and we all felt pretty good about what we had done, about the eyes we had opened, about the hearts that we had changed, even if just a little bit. This, despite the fact that there was at least one person in the administration who did not want our plans to succeed. As I reflect back on the birth of my activism, I'm convinced that the college gave me the freedom to find my voice in no small measure because the school knew deep down that we were right. The college was not a place of belonging for all kinds of bodies. And later, after graduation, I started going into schools and other places to share my story and talk about accessibility and help others to see the barriers that society had erected. And despite the Americans with Disabilities Act, the work continues because the need is greater than ever. My time at Conn also gave me the opportunity to see my disability as a part of my core identity. Thanks to people like Margie Lipschitz, our Dean of Residential Life, who was the first person to ask me to tell my story at the start of my junior year as a part of a freshman orientation program. And some alumni reached out to me, including Ellen Hoffmeyer-Bettman, class of 66, and Danielle Strickman, class of 66, among others, who wanted to assist with a committee on accessibility, led by then Writing Center Director Teresa Amirati. That helped me see and embrace myself as the disabled human that I was. To be clear, it took years for me to fully embrace the disabled part of my identity, and some days even now, I don't do it perfectly. That world of same continues to woo me, because all of us want to fit in. Even so, over many years of speaking in schools, houses of worship, and other organizations, I've come to the realization that disability is a fundamental part of what it means to be human. Everywhere I go, everyone I talk to, from Uber drivers to teachers, from TSA agents to cafeteria workers, everyone seems to have a story about disability. Everyone has a family member, a friend, a coworker who is disabled in one way or another. And everyone seems to want to tell their story because of a shared connection and a shared experience of being human. Indeed, it's the world of same with a beautiful intertwining twist. There is a postscript to my Disability Awareness Week story. Several years after I graduated, I got an out-of-the-blue phone call from the administrator I had suspected of being behind the call to the radio station, telling them our big day had been canceled. He had told me more than once before the event that he was worried about lawsuits. This time, on the phone, his voice was faint. He said he'd retired a few years ago, and he went on to explain that he'd recently had a heart attack, that he was using a wheelchair to get around. And he was calling to apologize, because now he fully understood what it was we were trying to do. You see, friends, disability is not just an integral part of the human condition. Disability gives us an opportunity to connect with one another in deep, interdependent ways. Disability is real and is beautiful and is a true gift. The Connecticut College Disability Cultural Center is a place that will give voice and agency and power and community and intersectionality and belonging to those who for too long have had to live on the outskirts of society. And it comes at a time in our nation's history when some people's identities and freedoms and senses of self are being threatened. Despite that, and maybe because of that, the center offers an invitation to those on the margins to come to the very center of the page and live their lives and stories to the fullest. Because their stories are everyone's story. Your story is my story, is our story. Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero is credited with saying, "We are prophets of a future not our own." And nothing could be more apt for the opening of the Disability Cultural Center. 40 years ago, we began a move toward making Connecticut College more accessible for future students, faculty, staff, parents, and alumni. And this center is doing the same work, both for members of the community today and for those of 1,000 tomorrows. This essay was adapted from John Sharon's speech at the grand opening event for Connecticut College's Disability Cultural Center in Smith House on April 1st, 2025. Next up is a piece from the Disability Scoop entitled "Pediatricians Get Updated Guidance on Diagnosing Developmental Disabilities" by Sean Heasley, published July 14, 2025. The nation's pediatricians are getting new guidelines for how to go about evaluating children who present with global developmental delay or intellectual disability. Doctors should use genetic testing to assess children early, according to a clinical report from the American Academy of Pediatrics, published recently in the journal Pediatrics. Genetic neurodevelopmental disorders are common in the pediatric population, and establishing a specific diagnosis early provides multiple benefits, the guidance states, noting that such information can help guide treatment and therapy decisions, provide access to support networks and clinical trials, and inform reproductive decisions, among other things. Genetic conditions account for up to 50% of cases of global developmental delay or intellectual disability with a known cause, according to the report. They can include chromosomal disorders like Down syndrome, monogenic disorders like Fragile X syndrome, imprinting disorders like Prader-Willi syndrome, and more. Genetic testing is most likely to yield a diagnosis in children with severe intellectual disabilities, with a cause identified in about 80% of cases versus only 20% in kids with more mild presentations. The odds of success with genetic testing are also increased if a child has abnormal features, congenital abnormalities, or neurological comorbidities, the pediatrics group said. For children with global developmental delay or intellectual disability, pediatricians should conduct an evaluation that includes a full medical, developmental, and family history, as well as a clinical exam. Vision and hearing exams, along with brain imaging, may be warranted in some cases, the guidance indicates. If a specific diagnosis is suspected, doctors should utilize more targeted genetic testing in order to save time and money. But when there is no likely cause, the report says a tiered approach is warranted. Initially, physicians should pursue either genome sequencing or exome sequencing coupled with chromosomal microarray. If that is inconclusive, then the guidance recommends screening for treatable inborn errors of metabolism and Fragile X testing. Finally, pediatricians are advised to conduct genetic sequencing if they haven't already, as well as a series of more specialized tests. The guidance notes that pediatricians can refer children to a geneticist, neurologist, or developmental specialist, but says it is vital for general practitioners to have a playbook to conduct an initial evaluation. The American Academy of Pediatrics report comes as new research finds that genetic testing for children with autism and intellectual disabilities remains rare for those who are insured by Medicaid. Only 17% of children with autism and 13% of those with intellectual disability received recommended genetic testing, according to the analysis of claims data from over 240,000 children ages 7 to 17 enrolled in Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program between 2008 and 2016. Genetic testing can offer valuable insights for diagnosis and care planning, said Dr. Tashley Brown of the University of California, Los Angeles, who led the study published in the journal Genetics in Medicine. But our findings show a major gap between what's recommended and what's actually happening in clinical practice among children who receive health insurance through Medicaid. And now a reminder that you are listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Our next piece comes from Psychology Today. It's entitled, The Liberating Power of Disability Pride, How Disability Pride Promotes Mental Health and Fights Ableism, by Kathleen R. Bogart, Ph.D., published July 7, 2025. Every July, Disability Pride Month celebrates the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA. This year marks the 35th anniversary of this landmark civil rights law. This month honors the achievements of the disability community in their ongoing fight against ableism. What is ableism? Have you ever seen messages in society that suggest people with disabilities are less than? That's ableism in action, a pervasive system of stereotyping, prejudice, discrimination, and social oppression directed toward disabled individuals. When these harmful societal messages start to seep into our own beliefs, it becomes internalized ableism. This can lead to feelings of shame and unworthiness. It's no surprise, then, that both ableism and internalized ableism are linked to low self-esteem, anxiety, and depression. What is disability pride? Disability pride is a movement to challenge ableism, a reaction to a long history of shame and exclusion. Disability pride is about feeling positive about your identity as a disabled person and feeling solidarity with others in the disabled community. It's about appreciating the unique strengths, creativity, and perspectives that come from living with a disability. It's not about toxic positivity or an overly optimistic outlook. Life with a disability involves very real challenges, and yes, every person with a disability will have moments of frustration or times when internalized ableism sends them into a shame spiral. The key insight is that many of these challenges aren't inherent to the disability itself, but are caused by ableism, societal barriers that can be changed. This realization was a driving force behind the ADA. How does disability pride help mental health? My research suggests that disability pride can act as a protective factor for mental health. In one study of people with multiple sclerosis, for example, disability pride was associated with lower depression and anxiety. Another study compared individuals born with mobility disabilities to those who acquired them later in life. Findings indicated that people born with disabilities often reported better mental well-being, possibly driven by higher levels of disability pride. While people who are born with their disabilities go through their initial developmental learning about themselves and the world alongside their disability, people who acquire disabilities must relearn how to navigate the world and often report feeling a loss of identity. Building disability pride takes time, and those with congenital disabilities may have a head start. Disability pride also seems to fortify self-esteem against the impacts of ableism. One study found that experiencing ableism was associated with greater disability pride, which in turn was associated with greater self-esteem. It's a powerful testament to how social barriers can galvanize people to challenge them. Indeed, people with disability pride are more likely to engage in advocacy and activism, efforts like those led to the passage of the ADA. How to build disability pride and mental health. Self-reflection is key. Reflecting on your own experiences with disability, acknowledging the challenges and the unique strengths and perspectives it brings, Examine your own beliefs about disability for any signs of internalized ableism and question where those views originated. It's time to reframe the narrative that disability is shameful. Seek professional help. If you are struggling with anxiety, depression, or other mental health symptoms, look for a therapist with specialized training or experience in disability. Our research finds that most psychologists do not receive sufficient training on disability. Those who are trained as rehabilitation psychologists or health psychologists, or who have sought extra education in disability affirmative therapy, are more likely to be savvy about disability issues. Don't hesitate to use free initial consultations to inquire about therapists' experience with disabled clients and familiarity with ableism. Educate yourself. Learn about the history of the disability rights movement, the ADA, and current advocacy efforts. Explore disability culture, including disabled artists, creators, and writers. Connect with the disability community. People with disabilities are at a higher risk of social isolation, which is a predictor of depression and anxiety. While the majority of people with a disability lack even one friend with a disability, just one disability friendship is associated with increased well-being. Seek out support groups and conferences, even virtual ones, and find role models and mentors within the disability community. These connections offer invaluable companionship and emotional support. Become an advocate. Get involved. Join a disability organization or advocacy movement. Dismantling barriers and challenging ableism doesn't just benefit you personally. It creates a better society for everyone. Ultimately, disability pride isn't just about individual well-being. It's a powerful force for changing society's views about disability. By celebrating disability as a form of human diversity, we can collectively work toward a society where everyone is valued, understood, and included. Through Disability Pride, we celebrate the history of the ADA and the value of people with disabilities in our society. This next piece comes from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. It is entitled, One Big Ugly Death Sentence for Disabled People, by Haley Brown, published July 8, 2025. On July 4th, President Trump signed into law a sweeping GOP budget reconciliation package, which he and the GOP proudly dubbed their One Big Beautiful Bill. The law is anything but pretty, however, for the millions of Americans with disabilities who stand to lose medical insurance coverage. The legislation imposes deep cuts to Medicaid and new work requirements, changes that threaten to strip essential Medicare from the very people who need it most. Medicaid plays an outsized role in serving the disabled population. Over 41% of working age, those ages 18 to 64, U.S. adults with disabilities rely on Medicaid for their health coverage, compared to just 13.2% of those without disabilities. The share of disabled working age adults enrolled in Medicaid is even higher in some parts of the country. 58.2% of working-age disabled adults in Puerto Rico rely on Medicaid, as do 46.3% in New Mexico and 43.8% in Massachusetts. Disabled people are disproportionately represented among those who use Medicaid. Among working-age adults, 28% of Medicaid enrollees report at least one type of disability, compared to just 7.7% of those who do not use Medicaid. The trend is also not confined to states that declined to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Disabled people who benefited from such Medicaid expansions face additional uncertainty in the wake of the cuts to federal funding. Several states that expanded coverage have so-called trigger laws, which require them to revisit or terminate their expansions if federal support falls below certain thresholds. If that happens, thousands of disabled adults in those states could lose coverage almost overnight, with no clear alternatives. These figures reflect persistent barriers to participation for disabled people. Full-time employment, and therefore employer-sponsored insurance, is often out of reach for disabled adults. Navigating alternative programs like Supplemental Security Income, SSI, or Social Security Disability Insurance, SSDI, can take years of appeals and paperwork requiring both money and expertise. Even among disabled Medicaid enrollees, only about 35% also receive SSI, and many don't have another formal recognition of their disability. Medicaid remains one of the only dependable ways that disabled people can access the medical care and equipment they need to survive. The new law reflects no such considerations, however, instead imposing punitive work requirements on Medicaid recipients with only limited and complicated exceptions for disabled people. These exceptions are structured so that many people who desperately need help will find it impossible to qualify. They risk cutting off coverage for many who don't qualify for SSI or SSDI, but still face significant limitations on their ability to work. Stringent work requirements also ignore the systemic challenges disabled Americans face, from inaccessible workplaces to employers failing to provide sufficient accommodations. Denying people health care does nothing to address these barriers. It only makes participation in work and community life even harder. Denying people health care does save money, however, money that the folks behind this bill are eager to redistribute to their wealthy patrons in the form of lucrative tax cuts. Rather than erecting new barriers to care, the U.S. should be moving closer to a system that treats health care as a right rather than privilege. This bill proceeds in exactly the opposite direction, and its devastating effects will be borne disproportionately by disabled people whom it treats as disposable. Next up is a piece from American University's University Library entitled, Celebrate National Disability Pride Month with These Reading Selections for the Library, by McKenna Casey, published July 14, 2025. July is here, and with it comes a slate of national and international holidays, awareness months, and summer celebrations. At the library, we are highlighting July as National Disability Pride Month with our main book display. National Disability Pride Day was first observed in July of 1990 to commemorate the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, into law on July 26th, and has since evolved into a month-long, officially recognized celebration. Since 1 in 4 Americans, over 70 million people, currently have a disability, and most people will have at least one in their lifetime, it is important to educate and celebrate this community of people and their stories. National Disability Pride Month Reading List. Disability Intimacy, Essays on Love, Care, and Desire, by Alice Wong. This much-anticipated follow-up to the groundbreaking anthology Disability Visibility, another revolutionary collection of first-person writing on the joys and challenges of the modern disability experience and intimacy in all its myriad forms. These 25 stunning original pieces, plus other modern classics on the subject, all carefully curated by acclaimed activist Alice Wong, include essays, photo essays, poetry, drama, and erotica, a full spectrum of the dreams, fantasies, and deeply personal realities of a wide range of beautiful bodies and minds. Disability intimacy will free your thinking, invigorate your spirit, and delight your desires. That's published by Penguin Random House. Next, Accessible America, A History of Disability and Design by Bess Williamson. Bess Williamson provides an extraordinary look at everyday design, marrying accessibility with aesthetic to provide an insight into a world in which we are all active participants, but often passive onlookers. Richly detailed with stories of politics and innovation, Williamson's Accessible America takes us through this important history, showing how American ideas of individualism and rights came to shape the material world, often with unexpected consequences. Published by the New York University Press. True Biz by Sarah Novick. The students at the River Valley School for the Deaf just want to hook up, pass their history finals, and have politicians, doctors, and their parents stop telling them what to do with their bodies. This revelatory novel plunges readers into the halls of a residential school for the deaf, where they'll meet Charlie, a rebellious transfer student who's never met another deaf person before, Austin, the school's golden boy, whose world is rocked when his baby sister is born hearing, and February, the hearing headmistress, a CODA, child of deaf adults, who is fighting to keep her school open and her marriage intact, but might not be able to do both. As a series of crises, both personal and political, threaten to unravel each of them, Charlie, Austin, and February find their lives inextricable from one another and changed forever. Published by Penguin Random House. Against Techno-Ableism, Rethinking Who Needs Improvement by Ashley Hsu. This badly needed introduction to disability expertise considers mobility devices, medical infrastructure, neurodivergence, and the crucial relationship between disability and race. The future, Hsu points out, is surely disabled, whether through changing climate, new diseases, or even through space travel. It's time we looked closely at how we all think about disability technologies and learn to envision disabilities not as liabilities, but as skill sets enabling all of us to navigate a challenging world. Published by W.W. Norton. On the Bright Side by Anna Sortino. Ellie's deaf boarding school just shut down, forcing her to leave the place she considered home and return to her hearing family. But being mainstreamed into public school isn't exactly easy. So her guidance counselor pairs her with Jackson, a student who's supposed to help her adjust. Can the boy who tries to say the right things and gets it all wrong be the lifeline Ellie needs? Exploring what it means to build community, Anna Sortino pens a story about the fear of the unknown and the beauty of the unexpected, all wrapped up in a poignant romance that will break your heart and put it back together again. Published by Penguin Random House. Nugene, One Girl's Incredible Journey from War-Torn Syria in a Wheelchair by Nugene Mustafa and Christina Lamb. Prize-winning journalist and the co-author of Smash New York Times bestseller I Am Malala, Christina Lamb now tells the inspiring true story of another remarkable young hero. Nugene Mustafa, a teenager born with cerebral palsy whose harrowing journey from war-ravaged Syria to Germany in a wheelchair is a breathtaking tale of fortitude, grit, and hope that lends a face to the greatest humanitarian issue of our time, the Syrian refugee crisis. Published by HarperCollins. Whether you're in the mood for essays, memoir, biography, young adult, poetry, fantasy, or contemporary fiction, Bender Library is your destination for books by and about people with disabilities. And finally, a piece from HuffPost entitled, "You Can't See My Disability, But How I Talk About It Has Changed My Life," by Dongmyung An, published July 10, 2025. It was the first day of the spring semester, and I nervously watched as my lecture hall filled up with what ended up being 48 students for my music history class. As a second-generation Korean-American with a difficult-to-pronounce name, I have always been a little apprehensive about first impressions. I stepped out from behind the podium on the stage, took a breath, and smiled. "I'm Professor An. I'll be your instructor for this semester," I told them. "I play early stringed instruments and specialize in the history of music from the medieval, Renaissance, and Baroque periods. And I stutter," I added. Public speaking is an occupational hazard for former presidents, poets laureate, and college professors. Basically anyone who's required to talk a lot. Faced with words on slide presentations or teleprompters that have pesky plosive consonants and vexing vowels, even the most eloquent of orators can falter. This probability is multiplied if you possess a speech impediment. According to the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders, normal speech is produced through precisely coordinated muscle movements controlled by the brain and monitored through our senses of hearing and touch. However, for those of us with speech disorders, these movements are often short-circuited. A stutter can stymie your speech, replacing it with the skipping sounds of a scratched record. Having mustered up enough centrifugal force from within to ask the ordinary, often transactional request, "Can I have a slice of plain pizza?" I surprised even myself when I chose to become a teacher. In middle school, some of my teachers deployed a bizarre and cruel tactic to prepare us for bullying in high school. They mocked us. And yet, my love of music history placed me in the classroom. The opportunity to guide students from early chant to the aleatoric music of John Cage far outweighing any fear of public speaking. Given what I went through when I started teaching, I became my own Office of Special Services, if you will, providing modifications to help me manage my disability. I adopted a more conversational, less didactic approach to lecturing, as well as a more empathetic philosophy of teaching. Life with a speech impediment produces both humility and chutzpah. Humility from having my voice thwarted continually, and chutzpah for persisting through it all. I didn't always disclose my speech disfluency right from the start. One afternoon years ago, while I was coaching my Baroque ensemble, I froze on a word. I felt the students' eyes on me as I hopelessly tried to extricate myself from that day's verbal quagmire. Exasperated, I finally just blurted out, "I have a stutter." Daria, a cello student, mature beyond her years, reassured me, "You're good. You're good." In that moment, my student became a mentor, confirming that my worth was not dependent on fluid speech. I've since continued to normalize my disability simply by being present, in the unextraordinary act of showing up, whether or not I am stuttering less or more on a given day. Recently, in an unfiltered moment, I told my class, albeit inelegantly, about how an extreme stuttering spell can be the result of exhaustion. I was newly tethered to the reality that exposure and the sharing of information ultimately can both demystify and relieve. This spring, I learned how the traditional teacher-student model could not only be flipped, but reshaped entirely. Okay, class, ite missa est, Latin for go, mass is over, I said, tongue-in-cheek, hoping my students would get the nerdy teacher joke that class, not mass, was over. As most of the students packed up, Peter, a gregarious baritone, bounded up the stairs to the stage. Dr. Ahn, he said enthusiastically, but a little sheepishly, I also have a stutter. I noticed the telltale yet almost imperceptible blink that accompanied the misspoken word. I was stunned. Wow, that's great. I do too, I said, taken aback. In that moment, I experienced a welcome moment of camaraderie with my student. Although there are over 3 million people in the United States who have this verbal block, until that moment, I had only met one other face to face, the father of a friend from camp whom I knew when I was a teenager. Throughout the semester, I was heartened whenever Peter raised his hand to answer a question. I was impressed by his lack of self-consciousness. He never looked ashamed, and, in fact, he sometimes even grinned. It helped that he had a supportive band of classmates. It was gratifying for me to witness such groundedness in him. When I was his age, I was an ever-reticent student, always terrified that a teacher would call on me, not necessarily because I wouldn't know the answer, but because I feared being unable to articulate my response. After the semester ended, Peter shared in an email how empowering it was to have a teacher who spoke like he did. His acknowledgement of our shared journey felt like a gift, helping me normalize what has always felt stigmatizing. In disclosing our disabilities, our vulnerabilities, Peter and I unintentionally helped transform the academic space into something less hierarchical and more human. A place where students and teachers could both learn from and support each other as peers. In my early years of teaching, I remembered hearing snickering from the class when I got stuck in lectures on Beethoven. I wondered if the students' skepticism was less because of my speaking style and more because they could sense how uncomfortable I was with myself. I now know that the more I accept my verbal stumbles and openly talk about them, the easier it is for others like me to feel accepted. And that concludes our program for this time. Thanks for tuning in, and please join us again next time for the Disability News on Sun Sounds of Arizona.